Oh, I've tried to record. Hello, by the way. I've tried to record this podcast so many times, and it's just come out as utter nonsense. My brain's very, very cloudy and congested at the moment. I just find it really, really hard to summon the words when I speak. Like, I feel intellectually insecure. Like, I'm not naturally erudite. Person, so I'm always striving for or grasping for a really well constructed sentence. Like, I'm not somebody who can speak in full sentences with ease. I can write well, but I can't necessarily speak well. And so when I've I mean, just some of these waffling on these. I've tried to record some of these episodes, but there is one I've got in the bag. I think I'll release it when I've listened back to it, because it's about, there's a Guardian article the brilliant Rachel Healy interviewed me for, along with Sean Morley and Ed Knight. And it's about the Me Too, like the Me Too within comedy. And the thing, women are tired of having to walk men through this. My quote there in the headline, the male comic standing up for Me Too. Now, that's slightly problematic, and I don't think it accurately conveys the angle of the article. Because by saying we're standing up for Me Too, there's the sort of white knight connotation, and that's problematic in its own way. And it looks like we're all expecting an attaboy or a pack in the back, when what we've done is done the absolute bare minimum. If you go on to read the article, you'll realize the title doesn't necessarily reflect the content. The article is brilliant, though, really. Rachel is, Look out for Rachel Healy on the Guardian website. She's got a whole cache of articles that focus on comedy and the comedy landscape, and they're excellent. And to coincide with that, this was just pure coincidence. I recorded an episode yesterday about our industry's Me Too, and about complicity and consent, trust, autonomy, all this stuff, where there's been a renewed focus on these topics and on discourse around it. But because it's a serious subject matter, I want to just make sure, listening back, I haven't said anything that comes across as quite flippant or tin-eared. And also, I don't want to come across like I'm speaking on behalf of women, because fuck those men. Fuck that. And the most effective contribution all of us men can have to an article like that came out yesterday is to highlight our own complicity, our own failings, and how we've done things that have allowed those predations to go unchecked, the predations of other men in the industry to go unchecked, and ensure that they've not been held to account. Not directly. A lot of it's indirect stuff, but it's we're just kind of all part of a culture that helps to perpetuate that awful behavior and misconduct. But you want to, if you're going to talk about something like that, commit it to a podcast. You want to do it justice. So I'm going to listen back and make sure I've done that. I was going to talk about work today. I could talk a little bit. I've only had so the jobs I've had, I'm a comedian and a writer. As you know, I worked in care work for a long time, for 9 years, and I also worked for G4S, where I guarded. I did 16-hour nighttime bridge watch at Silverstone, or I guarded the parade ring at Royal Ascot, where I had to shake hands with royalty, and Prince Pedo refused to shake my hand, looked me up and down, refused to shake my hand. So it is a part of me that's glad that he's been outed as a paedophile. Maybe allegedly, not. I mean, if there's one family who probably has a lot of legal ammunition, a phalanx of lawyers at their disposal, it's the royal family. So this is all said as a parody. I'm doing a parody of someone revealing that the royals are a pedo. If you guys, it's a character I'm working on. There's a character he talks about the royal family, assumes all of them are bloody pedophiles, being nutter, and then just says it on a podcast. Just a character I'm workshopping. That everything that I've said so far has been part of that character. So I was in character, now out of character, and there is no pedophiles in the royal family. No, not on my watch. No. They're all upstanding, morally chaste individuals. No. I think if there's a paedophile in the royal family, we would have heard about it. But I've not heard anything that will attest to that. So that's why this character that I'm doing is so absurd. He thinks the Queen's a pedo, but Prince Andrew's an actual paedophile. Went to an island full of them. So, and the photos that came out of there as well is. Anyway, let's get off this. I think I managed to sort of skirt that perilous legal quagmire quite artfully. Sorry if that no, it's gone now. I'm going to read some stuff from old notebooks. I was going to talk about. I'll read out the notes I've got for an episode about work. I've just written down. Elders being harvested for profit, and then it had an article called "Elder Abuse" by Andrew Cockburn. Andrew Singedick, Andrew Flametodge. But it talks about the American model, but it's like the business model is simple. It depends in part on the personal funds, including insurance policies of patients or their families, but in larger part on the government programs dedicated to caring for the elderly, like Medicare and Medicaid in America. It's a shell game, explained Doris Gelman, a Charlottesville, Virginia attorney who specializes in elder law. In the first go-round, a patient is covered by Medicare, which pays for treatment and rehabilitation, but only for a limited time. When the Medicare runs out, the patient can either go home or pay for long-term care. More often than not, they end up staying. This can drain away a lifetime of savings in short order, and once it does, Medicaid starts picking up the bill. But Medicaid will only spend a limited amount per person. In most of Virginia, including Richmond, the cap is $6,422 a month. Similar price to over here. The only way the home can make it worthwhile and meet their profit target is to cut corners, said Gelman. And that's why you have low paid, untrained, and overworked staff. Too right. It's pitiful the amount of money we're paid when we are frontline workers, in that we are there to stymie unnecessary hospital admissions and to provide the holistic and well-being to help the well-being of and provide holistic benefits to the elders. And we know them on a very personal level. We're very much enmeshed in their life. We're very close to them, like confidants. So we know them as people rather than an itinerary of ailments, itinerary, an index, or a list will do. List. Then the other notes I had here. Oh, this is about a book, the call center, working the phones, control and resistance in call centers by Jamie Woodcock. Oh, a lot of fucking flame oak prick. And that I'm only started that book, but I've just realized the subhead that is definitely up my street. I said the other day to someone, I felt a bit bad because if someone wrote massive screed because they had a sense of righteous injustice about something that they'd gone through. And they wrote, I'm a warrior. I'll always be a warrior. No one's going to put me down because I've got warrior blood or something like that. And I wrote underneath, when someone working in a call center watches Wolf of Wall Street for the first time. And then I've got people reprimanding me for not taking it seriously, which today maybe was right. I think they were thinking of me as a member of the Live Comedy Association steering group rather than just a comedian and a muckabouter in my own right. And it says, the drive for profit in some call center operations breaches norms about social behavior and sometimes even the law. I read an article where it said that the police are going to come in and fuck up your dinner on Christmas. I mean, it was in the Daily Mail. But it's police went to homes and break up Christmas dinners if families break lockdown rules, predicts police commissioner. They're coming and toot on your chicken. Upturned granny, sprinkled pubes in the gravy. And then in that book says, a labour process that does not provide a social benefit. And I think with my comedy, I've always said I want it to have some kind of social benefit. And, you know, just providing some much needed levity in a pandemic has a huge social benefit. That's why I think, you know, comedy clubs are very important places. Let's drink some Diet Coke. I ate a whole cylinder of chocolate. These Swiss chocolates from Marks and Spencer's. Extra fine milk chocolate discs. But they're like, I mean, they're like cut up into discs. But if you put them all together, they're basically just about 80 grams of chocolate cylinder. I can deep throat it out instantly. No mucking about. And I wanted to, with the social benefit thing, that's why I do stuff like the care home tour, even Pope's Addiction Clinic, to an extent it's a comedy AA or NA. When it works, it can be a very cathartic, profound experience. Like Campfire Confessional, you feel like you've all worked through something together. I was once going to create like a legitimate needle exchange and regulated sanctuary for drug addicts, where we would have medical professionals and stuff who were there to service them, to help them. And then I was going to roll into that bit of providing a social, something of a social function, a beneficial social function for drug addicts who are struggling, and for them to be able to inject safely, because they're depriving them of those resources ain't going to stop them from fucking squirting that cack up their arm. But yeah, I was going to roll into that a Pope's Addiction Clinic like a comedy show, but then that felt exploitative. This is basically, it's a marketing gimmick, isn't it? It's using junkies who are, you know, my kith and kin, but it's kind of you. It's using them in some way, isn't it? Which I don't want to do. The other thing I had written down here, Kafka themes. Why was we talking about Kafka? Ah, yes. So in that book about working the phones, it says here, the other side of the over-obsessed call center worker is the customer who is calling or being called. Mark Fisher, RIP, argues that the closest that most of us come to direct experience of the senselessness of capitalism is an encounter with the call center. The gaze of managers, corporations, and the state is one way. Trying to find out information or resolve a problem requires plummeting into the crazed Kafkaesque labyrinth of call centers, a world without memory, where cause and effect connect together in mysterious, unfathomable ways, where it is a miracle that anything happens and you lose hope of ever passing back over to the other side, where things seem to function smoothly. The repeating of the same dreary details many times to poorly trained and badly informed operatives, the building rage that must remain impotent because it can have no legitimate object, since, as is very quickly clear to the caller, there is no one who knows and no one who could do anything even if they could. Fisher draws on Franz Kafka's novel The Castle, which details Kay's struggle to gain access to the bureaucratic authorities. In one passage, Kafka describes Kay's encounter with the telephone system in the castle. I love that book. Fucking love Kafka as well. There is no specific telephone connection with the castle, no exchange that puts our calls through. When you call someone in the castle from here, it rings on all the telephones in the lowest departments there. Or rather, it would ring on all of them were it not for the fact, which I know for certain, that nearly all of them, the bell is switched off. Every so often, though, an overtired official feels the need for a little distraction, particularly in the evening or at night, switches the bell on, then we get an answer, except it's just a joke. And that's very understandable, after all. Who has any right to ring in about his private little troubles in the middle of the most important jobs, which are invariably being done in a tearing hurry? These prophetic lines seem to capture the experience of dealing with a modern call center. The confusing and often frustrating experience is one more akin to engaging with a decentralized market Stalinist bureaucracy than a central authority. The term Kafkaesque, often used to describe totalitarianism, is resonant in this circumstance. Another Kafka themes: the absurdity of life, the disconnect between mind and body, alienation, metamorphosis, the illogic becomes plausible, guilt goes unexplained, and brutal punishment is doled out for no known offence. A sense of striving even in the face of bleakness, and the characters as an inscrutability, shifting interplay between reality and unreality. I remember seeing something. So that's why David Lynch says that Kafka's his favourite writer. There's definitely a lot of overlap there. And I remember a Kafkaesque moment when we were talking about inscrutability or illogic, people reacting in ways that seem at odds with their circumstance. And there was a man who came onto a bus. The bus jolted, the man fell forward teeth first onto the sort of the plexiglass partition. His tooth hit the plexiglass, pinged out, and he went over, picked up the tooth and put it back into his pocket, and he got his ticket and sat down. But he didn't react in a way like, oh my God, my fucking tooth, or like, what have you done, or anything. He just quickly, rapidly picked up the tooth like he was embarrassed, being, even though his entire tooth had pinged out of his face. And like, none of us acknowledged what we'd just seen. He just went over to him, got the tooth popped in his pocket, got the ticket and sat down with the tooth in his pocket and a big hole in his face. A bit of blood, and he was just like dabbing the sort of frantically dabbing the hole with his sleeve. Is a weird way of reacting to something. Like, he was embarrassed that he was weak enough to lose a tooth or something. I don't know. And yeah, going by, so these ideas of a capitalist purchase a worker, worker's labor. So capitalist purchase a worker's labor power by employing them. The individualist subjectivity of sales, the responsibility of the worker to close the sale within the context of a call center, and in doing so, get rich and solve their own problems. So this idea of self-reliance. And what we're seeing with Marcus Rashford and his very noble and righteous tug of war with an almost sociopathic conservative government. And one of the conservative MPs, let me just find this, sorry about that. I'm just trying to find the... So MP, conservative MP Selain Saxby said, "I am delighted our local businesses have bounced back so much after lockdown. They are able to give away food for free and very much hope they will not be seeking any further government support." Fucking scumbag, right? It is just during a fucking pandemic of all things. And there's a problem with this radical self-reliance, this where people have to take responsibility into their own hands and that they can get rich and solve their own problems. But how would companies operate if each individual was only focused on self-enrichment or competitive self-enhancement? Because all the people within the nexus of a company infrastructure all feed into one another. They're interconnected and interdependent. And also, conservatives talk about this idea of self-reliance and, you know, pulling up your bootstraps and all that shit. But when they need to get funding from conservative donors, they're no longer that worried about self-reliance, independence, and all that shit. And as we talked about before, like Ayn Rand's idea of selfishness, and I've got this book, Ayn Rand's A Virtue of Selfishness. Fucking virtue, no virtue. In this, isn't everyone selfish? Some variety of this question is often raised as an objection for those who advocate an ethics or rational self-interest. Rational self-interest, yeah, that's... I'm fighting against that. The philosophy around that is everything I object to. For example, it's sometimes claimed everyone does what he really wants to do, otherwise he wouldn't do it. Or no one ever really sacrifices himself, since every purposeful action is motivated by some value or goal that the actor desires. One always acts selfishly, whether one knows it or not. I've gone in, and I know you're going to say now that by demonstrating that I'm a selfless person and saying this to you, the audience, the listener, that's the reward for this selfless act, because you'll think, oh, how selfless and virtuous and wonderful. And because you think that, I'm not going to tell you my selfless act. So there's no benefit. There you go, nip that in the bud. There's no benefit to it now. It just exists in my head. To untangle the intellectual confusion involved in this viewpoint, let us consider what facts of reality give rise to such an issue as selfishness versus self-sacrifice, or egoism versus altruism, and what the concept of selfishness means and entails. It's always fine to have ego. It's fine to be selfish in some ways, but Jesus Christ, create an equilibrium in your life where you're balancing it with some kind of altruism and selflessness. The issue of selfishness versus self-sacrifice arises in an ethical context. Ethics is a code of values to guide man's choices and actions. The choices and actions that determine the purpose and course of his life. In choosing his actions and goals, man faces constant alternatives. In order to choose, he requires a standard of value, a purpose which his actions are to serve or at which they are to aim. Value presupposes an answer to the question of value to whom and for what. What is to be the goal or purpose of a man's actions? Who is to be the intended beneficiary of his actions? You can benefit from your own actions and be the beneficiary, but don't make that the driving principle of every single thing you do. Also, do things for other people. Be community spirited. Be altruistic. Reach out and help other people as well outside of yourself. It doesn't have to be one or the other, or all or nothing. Not a zero-sum thing. Is he to hold as his primary moral purpose the achievement of his own life and happiness? But there's no, it's not a singularity. There's no like primary moral purpose. You can have different moral purposes that run simultaneously. Sometimes I'll throughout a day I'll do things for myself, but I do things for other people as well. But we'll get into that a bit another day. But yeah, I was going to read from some notebooks, but it actually has turned into the podcast I was hoping it would be before I settled on plan B, which was just read from the notebooks because my brain's gone to smudge, gone to abortion, my brain's abortion. If it's a partial birth abortion, what the fuck? I must have just read that so subconsciously. I've just opened up a notebook from the 6th of November 2018. And it says, if it's a partial birth abortion, it's Newt Gingrich 94, does that mean you have to raise a head and treat it like a full son? I'm not wasting money on a pram for that. I'll carry it in a bowling bag. I sit outside toilet doors providing instant feedback on the occupant's urinary performance. It's not all gold. Not all urine gold. I'd never kill myself because I'd never kill myself because it'd be so selfish to deprive the world of me. That's kind of like those hacky things you see on Twitter where people go, it woes me to be like such a hunky, big-dicked starlet or whatever. Oh, God. Oh, I'm just a wonderful person with big tits and all that. It's just a bit done, isn't it? It's like, I think kind of the Sarah Silverman laid out the blueprint for that type of comedy. But she did it so incredibly well. Of someone who lacks the self-awareness, there's a disjunct between what she believes is herself as like a virtuous, humble person, but within that she's actually bragging and self-idolizing. I'm nearly running out. Please don't sexualize breastfeeding. Please don't sexualize me masturbating my cummy penis in the gardening center. I have a mental condition. I do it to alleviate stress. I don't know why I've conflated that with breastfeeding. There's nothing wrong with public displays of breastfeeding. I'll read some more. I'll read some more in the next episode. Anyway, we're coming up to the end of this one. So, we got there in the end. Fucking million attempts. But thank you for listening. Love you all.